the home of Ole Jorgensen, Master Sergeant, U.S. Air Force retired, and we're discussing his involvement in what people are now describing as the Roswell incident.
Yeah. All right. Well, I spoke with you previously, mm-hmm. and we discussed a situation that came up during your Air Force career that we think people have been misrepresenting to say that there was a flying saucer and an alien body and things like this. I'll just outline what we're doing and what we're working on. Is last summer we produced a large report for the Secretary of the Air Force that described an event that occurred in 1947 that people believed was a flying saucer type event, which we're certain was not, and we have we produced a report that proved that. Subsequent to that, we come upon new information that looks like some of these people are describing events not only from 1947, but from throughout the 50s into the 60s, and we think even into the 70s, describing a bunch of events and then saying that they all happened at one particular 1 or 2 day period in 1947. We know this isn't true, and one of the incidents that they're using to make this case is an incident that we think that you were involved in firsthand basis. So I'll just start out with you could just tell me when you joined the Air Force and what.
Okay, I joined the Air Force in June 20th, 1957, after I graduated from high school. I didn't go to, I went to basic training for 11 weeks. Normal basic training was 4 weeks, but I took a bypass test in electronics and passed it, and consequently took the second phase of basic training at Lackland in lieu of at the tech school, where they give you your second half, if you will. And after that, I was assigned as a ground communication and electronic repairman, because I had about 4 or 5 years of electronic experience as a young kid, and had my radio amateur license. My first assignment was at Carswell Air Force Base, where I stayed for about 6 months. I was in 58 until finished with the basic, I went straight to Carswell, and in 58 then I was sent to Kwajalein, a little rocket, 1x3 rocket on Kwajalein, and it was a Navy base. I was assigned to a 1987, I believe it was, COM squadron. About 150 Air Force guys there. That was during the atomic tests.
Okay.
And stayed there for a year. And upon finishing that tour, I was sent straight here to Holland Air Force Base. I was supposed to report in April, first part of April. And in fact, I gave you a copy of my order somewhere. Mm-hmm. And I arrived early. I arrived here about the 22nd, 23rd of March, something in that neighborhood, and when I was assigned to the Bloom Branch, I was part of the communications section at that time, and I was the 16th guy in communications, huge section, and at that time there was about 125 people, something like that, left in the Bloom Branch. They had gone down from about 150 down to this, and they were still reducing it. We got down to a level of about 70, 75 within about a year.
Now, even though that's the period of time we're interested in, I'd just like you to, if you could just go on and just tell me some of the other positions that you held throughout your Air Force career.
Sure. Well, I came here in March of 59, and as a young two-striper, I made, at that time I was called Airman Second Class, and I made Airman First Class and Staff Sergeant in the Balloon Branch. I left the Balloon Branch in 1966. I believe it was July of 1966. I can look that up. I'm sure I have the information.
You were there quite a while. That's what, two tours?
No, that was one tour.
One tour.
And the joke was you had to get discharged. You had to retire or get discharged or die to get out of there. And but with Nam coming up, they started moving people around quite a bit. And since I had a hot AFSC that was needed in Nam, I volunteered worldwide. And they sent me. Well, originally they gave me France. Originally they gave me Berlin, and I was going to be signed there. But due to the fact I was born in Europe and still had some relatives there, they had assigned me to a sensitive position. They canceled that assignment and said, we're going to give you a better one. They sent me to France. And of course, De Gaulle had already kicked us out then. But I went to France anyway and finished and was one of the few last ones to get out of France. I spent roughly I left there in December of 66, I guess it was. I went to Germany, and I spent the remaining time in Germany until 69, and I volunteered and asked for special assignment to get back to the Balloon Branch, mm-hmm. because in the Balloon Branch I had what they called an E prefix, mm-hmm. and that meant research, and so I used that to get back. Yeah, at that time it was called Special Assignment, and I did receive orders to come back to the Balloon Branch. I returned as a tech sergeant in 69. My assignment in Germany, and when I went to Germany, by the way, I was in the 2nd Mobile Comm Group in charge of heavy transmitters and receivers and so forth. And with crypto clearance because of me was part of NATO as well. Mm-hmm. Anyway, when I came back to the Balloon Branch for a short while, we had a captain in charge. He left within 6 months, and then I took over the shop again as a tech sergeant.
And you're in charge of the comm shop?
Well, in the comm shop, and later, probably in 70, we merged the comm and the instrumentation together. So we became communication instrumentation section. And because we just didn't have enough people to do both. And shortly after we got a captain that came in, Captain Barry. And that was about 70, maybe 71, 70, something in that neighborhood. And at that time, we really built our section up quite big because we had Project Viking. In fact, we got, and I turned out to be the NCIC of the shop during that time period. I worked closely with Mr. Cowley and Mr. Lopin. Well, Mr. Lopin has passed away now. But Ralph Cowley, and you may have heard of, I can't think. Anyway, part of that group. I stayed there until 1973. Oh, I also did myself, and I took one of my young buck sergeants with me. I went up to Chico, to our site up in Chico, and we launched the largest balloon in, what's the name of that? I forget the name of the project. High Rise, I think it was. No, maybe, yeah, I guess it was High Rise.
How large was that balloon?
It was the largest thing going. 40,
it was like 40 million.
48, something like that, I think it was. And it went to 168, 170,000 feet anyway. And then I went, from there I went to, my 4 years was just about up. Mm-hmm. And they gave me an assignment to go to Guam to be in charge of scope control there on Guam. And I didn't know what scope control was, mm-hmm. but anyway, it was, that was what they call the President's Communication System. So I went to Advanced Scope Control School in Keesler for gosh, I forget how long it was now, 6-8 weeks, something like that. Mm-hmm. Went to Guam and held the position as NCIC of Scope Control and made master over there. And volunteered to come back and fought like the Dickens. In fact, I wrote the Air Force a letter to get back. I remember Major Burnett, I don't know if you ever met Burnett, he's still here in town. He was commander in Bloom Branch during some of these times, not during the time that we're talking about.
He was telling me about
it. Yeah, Major Burnett, he was the commander of Chico as a captain, and then later, of course, here.
And then you came back to the
Bloom Branch? Then I came back to the Bloom Branch.
So you came back for your third time?
That was my third term.
So yeah. What year was that?
That was 1975, and I retired in 77. So I spent about 13 and a half years in the Bloom Branch. In 1980, after I retired, I went to work for Raytheon as a field engineer for them. But only for 2 months, my daughter had some problems. I was going to go overseas with him. I couldn't take her with me, so I terminated that job, went to work for Dynalectron as a site chief on the range. And worked there for the next 5 years, but my back kept on giving me problems. I wound up in the hospital and everything else, just severe muscle spasms, stress, and so forth. So anyway, I quit work in 1982. In 83, Mr. Ralph Cowie called me and I went out to work for they asked New Mexico State University to pick me up. And I redid their control center, their transmitter buildings.
At the Bloom Branch?
At the branch, as a consultant for them, I actually did the work. First I wrote up the report, what it would take to fix it, and get everything back to working order, and I took care of that, and after everything was working, because they couldn't talk to the aircraft, they couldn't command the balloons, they didn't have any training program, and they still don't. It's a really a shame. I think you heard us talking some time ago about that.
Uh-huh.
I worked there on and off for 2 years. They were running short on funds, and that was it, basically. So that's, right now, After that, I did some consultant work for NASA. I went out to California. We took a scope down off the hill up here, which is part of the old AFGL, by the way. Yeah. That was under the AFGL, sitting up in a mountain. You would look up and look at, Russian satellites. They could really see all that stuff. Anyway, that scope had been out of use for a long time, and the astronomers out I'll get the information. I can't think of the name of the mountain out there. Out in California, Redwoods.
Okay.
Anyway, we took the scope down here, packed it up, sent it out to the mountain out there, and myself and two other guys went out there, and they built a new base for it, new house, new dome and everything for it, and we put the scope all back together and then wired it up so we could make that scope tie in the computer so the computer could tell it where to look at it and drive it and so forth and so on. I worked for there, and then I went out there and did some other work for another company out there. It's a small range out there where the mockingbirds, come back. Capistrano, out there in that area. They have a small range out there. We went out there, me and another guy went out and did some consulting work for them. We put up some towers and they hung lasers on them and so forth and so on. And then last year and a half ago, I guess it was, I went out to the Mississippi, Missouri River when they had all that flooding down there and they had all them boats, a lot of those tugboats, they don't know where those boats are at any given time. They do have HF, but they don't use very much, and they do have the cellular phones, but they want to know at a given instant where they're at, what cargo they're hauling, where to drop the various barges, where to pick up new ones. So we put a computer in with a transponder and so forth to send it up to the satellite and come back to the station, and they could direct and do all their reporting, morning logs, and tell them where to go and so on. So that's it. Now, right now, I just have a a little part-time job down at Foxford Galbert. I man the gate down there, and that's just about 28, 30 hours a week for that, just to keep me in the public, and it doesn't bother my back, and I can begin to move around a little bit freely, and it lets me take a trip like I just told you that we just took, so that's about it.
Seems to me you got a lot of experience in ballooning, so.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I guess that brings us to your time at the Balloon Branch, the first tour.
Mm-hmm.
You got there in April of 59.
March
of 59.
Mm-hmm.
And about this time is when Captain Joe Kittinger was conducting, he started in May to conduct some training missions to train some backup pilots for his high altitude flights.
Stargazer.
Right.
That was his project, Stargazer. Mm-hmm. Yep, you bet.
And the particular night in question, according to the records, is the evening of May 20th, 1959 to May 21st, 1959, the morning of the 21st, night of the 20th, day of the 21st. And if you could just tell me what you remember about that particular mission.
Yeah, I hadn't been to Branch for a couple of months, and there had been several other flights, training flights, three or four of the training flights that Captain Kittinger had made with these other people to train him so they could act as backup on Project Stargazer. And I was picked to go with a guy who later was my roommate and a good friend, Lewis Wacker. He was an airman second. He may just have made airman first, or shortly thereafter he made it. But anyway, I went with him in one of the three-quarter ton ambulances that were the Second World War, Korean War vintage type ambulances. There was no Red Cross or anything on them. They had all been painted out. I've given you some photographs of it, and they've got, we had bars across it. And on the top of that bar, we had all our antennas mounted, and we had our DF on it, and so that's what we used. And then along, on all flights, we would have communications guys at the launch site. If it was a launch site here at Holloman, we would still have two guys comm on the fly line, but if it was remote, we would still have two guys for comm at the launch site, and then we would also send the ambulance out. We call it ambulance, it has nothing to do with an ambulance, but it was an old converted ambulance. We'd send that out in the field to provide the communications back to Holloman, and it had communication between us and the recovery vehicle via VHF communications, because they had VHF in the weapons carrier, and we could also then use it between air to ground, both VHF and UHF, to helicopters or spotting planes. But at that time we used C-123s quite a bit. In fact, we had, I think the base had at one time up to five C-123s, just for their sole justification was the balloon branch.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so that's what we used. That's why we went along as come. When the flight, that flight was launched in the evening.
Were you at the launch?
I was not at the launch, no. They launched it in the evening, and where we kept in contact with them, they had they would visible contact, they would use light flares ever so often, like the ones the highway patrol would use, mm-hmm. hold them down, and to do that, and we also could talk to them, and I can't remember what we gave them, if we gave them a handheld handy talkie, and in those days it wasn't the little handhelds like you have now, but it was the bigger ones, so we could talk to them on VHF. I can't quite remember that, but it seemed like we did, but I maybe. Guess not. But I can definitely remember them lighting four or five flares all night.
So how did you, okay, you weren't at the launch, so how did you catch
Well, we just took off from here. We knew they were going to launch. They're going to launch here, and at this launch time, and they're going and Duke, Mr. Gillenberg would give us the trajectory, and we just went where they told us it was going to go, and they assured us that we could contact them, keep in touch with them if we followed the road, and we didn't. They flew over the road very well, and we could see their flares all along. And once in a while, we would stop at a payphone and call back position to Duke, to our control center.
You couldn't call the control center on your VHF?
No. Once you're over the mountains, you can't. Now, later on, and that was one thing that they, you see some of these, they have whips on them now.
Uh-huh.
And we had some troops that didn't, that weren't really, they were communicators, they were supposed to be communicators,
mm-hmm.
like I told you, this guy here and others.
Uh-huh.
But and you may recall when we had a discussion with Bob Blankenship and so forth.
Yeah.
They just, what do I have to do? If I want to go out there, I think at that time we do $9 per diem.
Yeah.
Which uh-huh. supposedly big money. But they wanted to get away from base and go out and do that, and they thought that was fun. But seriously, they could never communicate from once you got on the other side of the hill and the rise and all that. Well, during the time they were flying, we was moving and we could not communicate because we had whips and they were not very efficient and not very good. So when we would stop and so forth, then of course later on, not on these flights, but later on, we would stop halfway at, I'd climb up a tree and put an antenna up and talk back to them. We'd get to Roswell. We'd climb up the tower that had the rotating light
uh-huh.
and string up a wire and talk back to Roswell. I mean back to Holloman.
Uh-huh.
And that's why Bob picked myself and Lou's wife quite a bit, because he knew that if he and I went out, we would get communication for them folks.
Mm-hmm.
But, so on that morning, on that flight, I know they had been up several times before on other flights. On that flight, it was going at night, and they were concerned about it, but they said we could talk to them, and we could see them with their flares. And so I think that they had, and I don't know if this picture here depicts it, I'm not sure what that is right there.
Uh-huh.
Is that a handy? That's almost like a handheld handy talkie or something
mm-hmm.
like that? I'm not positive about that. But I think they had something. I know definitely. That I'm almost positive that we could talk to them.
Uh-huh.
But I can't swear to that. But all I know is we followed them all night with their flares. And it started getting daylight. I took some slides. I took about three or four. I took three pictures, and you have copies of those.
Get back to what we were saying is that you took.
I took three photographs
on
the date of the flight, on the date of the incident.
Okay.
I took three photographs of that, and it was just beginning to get daylight, and Captain Kittinger sat down in an open field. We drove right up to him, and we discussed. I was just a young troop, so I sure didn't have no authority or responsibility, basically, other than provide communications. And he, there was myself and Lewis Wacker and the recovery team,
team. Two comm guys, yourself and Lewis Wacker,
yeah.
And then two more recovery people.
You bet. And they were in a weapons carrier.
They were in a weapons carrier,
mm-hmm.
Okay.
We drove up to him. He offered us a cup of coffee from a thermos. We each had a sip or so. He says he's going to make one more ascent and one more land, and then land, and that would be it for the flight. We said, fine, Danny. And we drove off, away from the balloon. He ascended, and it doesn't seem like we had gone 10 minutes, if that long, and we didn't see the balloon anymore right over or something like that, but we heard a bang. And that was the script that exploded.
Yep.
Captain Kittinger detonated the script. And so we hurriedly drove over to where we thought it was. And what we saw, of course, there was a field there. And it was a cornfield that had been just recently cut. We drove in there through the gate of that cornfield. I remember there was a gate there. We opened up it and drove on in there. The gondola was laying tipped over on the side like that.
Okay.
And there was a helmet laying down on the ground, and it was all shattered in the front.
Mm-hmm.
The one of the participants, one of the captains, was laying there, and he was bruised, and there was blood on him. Captain Kittinger, as I recall, had a couple scratches here and there, nothing major. We asked what happened, and Captain Kittinger said that he made a decision to blow the script, and he showed us, and I can vividly remember him turning around and saying, see the power lines? I was coming in. I thought I could come in those power lines if I came right behind him, and there was a big row of trees, almost like out in the Midwest or up north, Minnesota, and places like that. We have windbreakers, you know.
Yeah.
So he said, I thought I could come in and land between this power pole and here, and I started coming in, and when I got into it, I knew I couldn't. I thought he said he was about 200 feet off the ground. He decided to just blow the script and hoping that the chute would catch him.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, the chute didn't catch him, and they came down and dumped and hit, and the bags turned over, and it threw them all out. And that's when that captain hit his head, and luckily he wore his helmet, because if he hadn't worn the helmet, he'd been dead. I'm convinced of that.
So the helmet saved his life.
You betcha. As far as I'm concerned, I don't know. Because I couldn't believe that helmet was crashed like that. Anyway, it was shortly thereafter, I feel relatively positive about this, that we were the first ones on the scene.
Mm-hmm.
We were there before any helicopter was there or anybody else was there. Because we had just talked to them 8-10 minutes or something like that. And boy, when we didn't see him, we drove over. We knew there was an area there. We could see all the trees. He must be over there. So we drove over, and there he was in the field. Of course. So shortly thereafter, the helicopter sat down, it loaded the people up,
okay,
and drove them to Walker. We picked up some stuff, and we drove to Walker.
Okay.
Now I just don't know what we went to Walker for. I know we went to Walker, and we drove up to the hospital. And we sat there for a little bit. I guess it was to maybe find out what the status was, and we gave some personal items that had fallen out of the or whatever, because and I think we used the telephone, and we called back to Holloman and talked to the control center. And I sure wish those records were available. I cannot believe we can't that they don't have those.
Yeah.
But anyway, that was the chain of events. We did not, to my recollection, we helped roll up the chute, we gathered up the thing, and we load all four of us loaded that stuff onto the weapons carrier.
We loaded the gondola and the chute?
The gondola, the chute, and onto the weapons carrier. Now the balloon, I don't know exactly. I cannot remember what happened to the balloon. It didn't come down right there, of course.
How far? Whereabouts? You said you went over to Walker. How far do you think you were from Walker when this crash happened?
Oh. In our vehicle, it don't seem like it was more than 15, 20 minutes. That's my recollection of it. But I mean, time-wise, I could be wrong. A lot of things happened, and I wish I could remember some of the more detail, but at that time it was just another flight, and a guy that got in trouble knew that he had to do something, and Captain Kitchen made a decision to go the way he did, and it was unfortunate that this one guy got hurt a little bit.
So you went over, the gondola was on its side, and they were kind of collecting themselves. One guy was injured.
Mm-hmm.
Then you say not too much longer, a helicopter came.
Mm-hmm. It'd
be similar to H-21.
Mm-hmm.
Came down, and then
mm-hmm.
they jumped, got on board the helicopter.
We got them on board the helicopter, and they flew straight to Walker to the hospital, I guess, to
okay.
the wherever they landed them on the pad there. or what have you, but that's what happened. All I know is we went over all, maybe we got there. We actually arrived at Walker a couple hours later. Something like that. An hour and a half, 2 hours later, we actually arrived at Walker. Mm-hmm. This was after we policed and got the gondola loaded mm-hmm. in the weapons carrier. The parachute rolled up, loaded in there, weapons carrier. And the balloon, I'm sure we had to pick that up. I don't remember picking it up.
Okay. Do you remember now when you got to Walker? Do you remember where you parked the ambulance? You say you went to the hospital?
No, I sure don't. It seemed to me, now both of us, the weapons carrier, I'm sure. You know, I'm trying to think of that, and it seemed to me that both of us drove on over there and parked by the, was a sidewalk, I think there was a ramp. And there was parking over here, and I think we just parked right here, the two of us, parked right there. We did whatever we did, and it didn't, we did nothing that really impressed me as to what we did that was outstanding. So, and like I said, I've only been in the balloon branch for 2 months at that time, so I don't know what was going on other than the fact that, you know, that the one pilot got hurt. It seems that, and I wish I could remember the recovery people. But they, I think they talked to Captain Gittinger.
Okay.